I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday afternoon. Thanks to John Munson for filling in for me last week while I had a long Thanksgiving celebration with the family. All things political, which you always hear Mondays at 1 o'clock, and we have a lot to talk about this hour. Wisconsin's recount of the presidential election will begin on Thursday of this week. We'll discuss that. President-elect Donald Trump calls it a scam and says the results should be respected instead of being challenged and abused. Yesterday, he tweeted, "In addition to winning Electoral College in landslide, I won the popular vote if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally." We'll talk about some of his latest appointments. Betty DeVos for Education Secretary, a proponent of vouchers for private and parochial schools, his potential business conflicts. And we'll look at this whole important issue that was so crucial in the election and the rise of Donald Trump and also of Bernie Sanders, attacking inequality. Our guest says political insurgents have challenged the complacent establishment of both parties and shows how we can restore the promise of economic mobility and equality by pursuing socialist ends through capitalist means. Our guest this hour is F.H. Buckley. Frank is a foundation professor at George Mason University's Scalia School of Law. He's a frequent media guest, has appeared on Morning Joe, CNN, Rush Limbaugh, CBC, and NPR. He's a senior editor of The American Spectator, also a columnist for The New York Post. He's written for many publications, including The Wall Street Journal, The American Conservative, and he is author of several books, including his most recent, The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America. We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Frank, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Kathleen, thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Well, let's start because we're in Wisconsin with the recount of the presidential election, which will begin on Thursday. Pennsylvania evidently will be next, and maybe Michigan will be next. The president-elect has called it a scam and says the results should be respected instead of being challenged and abused. Do you agree with that? Is it a scam?
Well, I don't know if I'd call it a scam. I think it is kind of ridiculous. I recall how before the election, everybody dumped on Trump for saying that questioning whether or not he would respect the election, and guess who's questioning the election at this point. So I don't think it's going to go anywhere. It may have the curious effect of throwing the election to the House of Representatives for the first time since 1824, but in any event, who the president will be is quite clear.
Meaning what, that the vote would have to be changed in all three states to throw it to the House?
Well, the vote's not going to be changed. I mean, the result's going to remain. But what happens if on the date at which the electors are to meet, which is, I think, December 19, somehow things are still up in the air with respect to some states because there's a hand counting going on? If that's the case, and the electors in the respective states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin can't cast their ballots because it's, you know, there's a hand count going on. At that point, it goes to the House of Representatives, according to the Constitution, and they'll simply choose Trump. The House of Representatives would then vote by state, and unquestionably, Trump would win. It may be that the thinking here is that this would go further to delegitimize the election in the eyes of some people, and that may be the only thing we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, he sent a tweet, and it was talked about quite a bit. Let me ask your response to it. In addition to winning Electoral College in landslide, I won the popular vote if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally. Do we have any evidence that there were millions of people who voted illegally?
Nope. That's my short answer.
So you don't know why he did that?
I can see how he might have been irritated, but I don't know that there's any evidence for that whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. We're also witnessing over the weekend a great deal of tweeting about who the Secretary of State should be. Kellyanne Conway talking about Mitt Romney really disrespecting the president-elect and indicating her strong displeasure for him, indicating perhaps she's for Giuliani. Do you know anything about what's going on here and who has the upper hand in terms of being nominated? And do you have a preference?
I have a preference. I mean, it's all kind of Byzantine. I mean, the latest is Kellyanne Conway is kind of in the doghouse for voicing her opposition to Mitt Romney. I don't think Mitt Romney would be an appropriate person. And it's not simply that he did whatever he could to torpedo Trump during the election, but the greater problem, in my view, is that he's too closely connected to the neocons. I mean, if you pick Trump, if you pick Romney, his first phone call would be to people like Dan Senior and the Kagan brothers. Dan Senior is, by the way, the guy who was running the foreign policy team for Romney in 2012. And his fingerprints were all over the release of the 2005 tape, the notorious tape involving Donald Trump. So, you know, totally disloyal, but really a complete reversal of Trump's ideas with respect to foreign policy, which was a repudiation of nation building, of the neocons, of George W. Bush's foreign policy. I was comfortable with that. I saw Trump as the peace candidate relative to Hillary Clinton, and I wouldn't want that to change.
Mm-hmm. So you would prefer who for Secretary of State?
Well, I suppose Giuliani, possibly. There's this Democratic Congress lady from Hawaii whose name escapes me at this point, but she might be quite suitable. But, you know, really what you want is somebody on board with the idea that we have moved away from the standard Republican foreign policy, which did so much to hurt the party, right? The idea of embarking in foreign wars in search of foreign monsters to destroy it. Now, that wasn't very popular, and there's no particular reason why we want to go back to that.
Mm-hmm. So if you see Donald Trump as the peace candidate, what about his comments to bomb the hell out of ISIS?
Well, you know, the one exception was he thought that we should be doing something with respect to ISIS. And his thought on the subject involved working with Russia. Incidentally, at this point, John Kerry has embarked on some kind of a peace mission involving the Syrian, quote, rebels, unquote. There are a lot of really distinguished foreign policy people who say those rebels are simply al-Qaeda in Iraq and or in Syria. You don't really want to have very much to do with them. There's a split between the parties over the subject of the Russians. It's all very odd, but one sees echoes of this in suggestions that we need a risk recount in Wisconsin because the Russians are interfering with the election. There's no more evidence of that, I think, than there is evidence of Donald Trump having won the popular vote. I just think that's kind of a made-up story, but I can see how it might advantage Hillary Clinton in some way. But I don't think that America's foreign policy should be dictated by domestic policy concerns or advantaging one political party over the other. I mean, it's, you know, we don't want boots on the ground in Syria. If there is some way of defeating ISIS without any of that, which might involve working with the Russians, and that's something we might want to think about.
Mm-hmm. There has been concern, and it's kind of an amorphous issue because nobody's done serious investigative reporting here about Donald Trump's connections with Russia, with Putin in particular, with various figures, with his national security advisor giving a speech, invited by Russian television. Do you see something here that needs to be investigated?
Not particularly. I mean, he has business contacts. I guess he has a hotel in Moscow. He is not personally on the hook with respect to any debt obligations in Russia. But he's simply a businessman, and he has dealings all over. But I don't think that businessmen should per se be disqualified from running for political office. And that would include a businessman who has ties all over the place. As to the idea of the Russians secretly controlling what's going on, I mean, I think Joe McCarthy from Wisconsin is calling to say, I want my red baiting back.
In terms of business dealings, there's been a lot of reporting, New York Times, The Atlantic today, about Donald Trump's business dealings and some concerns about potential big conflict of interest. Do any of these dealings, would you prefer that he put all of this in a blind trust? Do you have any concerns about his business dealings?
Well, I think it probably would be better if something like that were set up. And a lot of people have suggested exactly that. I mean, the Wall Street Journal, for example, has come out in favor of that. And I don't, you know, frankly, I don't know the best way of doing it. I mean, a fire sale of all assets would be, you know, very, very painful and extremely costly. But, you know, wiser heads than mine with respect to business dealings might perhaps find a way out of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree. I mean, look, one of the problems with Hillary Clinton was the concern that the Clinton cash machine was all about dinging foreign governments
right.
for money. And amusingly, the government of several governments immediately zeroed out contributions to the Clinton Foundation. And one wag, by the way, suggested that Hillary Clinton has agreed to give a talk to Goldman Sachs in return for a brand new toaster.
And yet we have news that he has extensive dealings in Saudi Arabia as well. His company is operating and opening new properties there. According to the Washington Post, registered 8 new companies in Saudi Arabia during the presidential campaign. This is a country that's highly problematic on many, many fronts. Their take on this was that it bodes ill for his ability to separate his personal and presidential interests, but also calls into question the honesty and transparency of his campaign.
Well, you know, what was there to choose? I mean, Hillary Clinton was getting lots of money from Saudi Arabia and from all of the human rights abusers in the world, and that indeed was, in fact, a problem. One would have had a similar problem unwrapping the Clinton cash machine from that kind of problem. As I say, yeah, it'd be nice if one found some business way of curing the problem, and the Wall Street Journal has suggested something like that. I'm not quite sure what the best way of doing it would be. I'm not the financial guru for the Trump businesses.
Mm-hmm. You, in your book, talked about political insurgents, and boy, were political insurgents ever the story of 2016, challenging, you write, the complacent establishment of both parties and showing, and I want you to talk more about this, how we can restore the promise of economic mobility, which is crucial, I think, to whoever's going to run for president next, and equality by pursuing socialist ends through capitalist means. Is that what Trump is going to do?
Well, one is permitted to hope, let's put it that way. In any event, my book was prompted as by more than anything my real feeling of disgust for the Republican establishment, which completely ignored issues of inequality and immobility. And you know, Mitt Romney ran on his 59-point economic recovery plan, which nobody read, right? But what they heard from Romney was the business about the 47% of takers. And meanwhile, Obama persuaded people that he had their back. And I don't think that turned out all that well. But at least he showed some concern, which was more than the white shoe Republicans could do. So I think the Republicans needed an entirely different voice. They needed somebody who was going to say, look, this is a real issue. And specifically, somebody who could approach the Sanders people on the left and say, look, we have similar goals in all of this, right? I mean, you want a just society, and a just society in part is a society of people who are not separated by extreme differences in wealth, and in particular, a society where there are no barriers to mobility. And then what I did, since I'm a dual, I spend most of my life in Montreal, I looked at comparisons between this country and Canada, and it just blew me away because, you know, the American dream is this is a country where wherever you are, whoever you are, you can get ahead. And George Carlin said it's called the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe in it. But then when I looked at Canada, I realized the American dream is alive. It just moved north of the border. And in particular, if you look at the top 10% of Americans and the bottom 10%, what you see is people at the bottom end who pass on their immiseration to their kids and an aristocratic elite at the top end whose kids are going to do really well. And then I went to Canada and I saw, boy, it's really level. You know, if you're in the bottom 10%, you've got a very good chance that your kids are going to make it all the way up. And if you're in the top 10%, there's a pretty good chance your kids are going to move down the ladder a fair bit. And that's kind of, you know, our intuition of social justice has a lot to do with that. And indeed, mobility is even a bigger issue than equality. I mean, we're prepared to accept inequality if we think our kids will have it better off. So that, you know, that was just a huge issue. And for the first time in American politics, a couple of years back, Americans told pollsters they don't think their kids will have it as well off as they would. And right. that's the election.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is the election. So why didn't you support Bernie Sanders?
Well, because I thought that he wasn't going to go about it the right way. I mean, you know, I looked at the issue and I said, right, well, what do you do to get to move, you know, to get back to our imagined America, which was never a completely real America, but an imagined America of mobility. And so you look at Canada and you say, well, how is it different? And it's different in a lot. It's very similar in a lot of ways, and it's very different in some ways. I'm not opposed to Canadian Medicare in any way. I think Canadian Medicare can be tweaked, but it's basically works well, and the proof is everybody loves it up there. But then there are other things like immigration, where Canada has a really, what you would describe as very restrictive conservative immigration policy, which is more or less, I think, roughly what Trump had in mind. And Trump actually plugged my book and specifically what I said about immigration. So if you want to know, you know, what he's thinking about immigration, you could look at the book. I mean, it proves to my mind either, you know, he's a good guy or else he didn't read the book. You take the pick, okay?
What do you suspect?
Yeah.
He must have read the book, right?
I won't say.
Okay. Oh, he must have read the book. Let's talk about this $1 trillion infrastructure. He's talked about this. Is this a way for people to start achieving some economic mobility, and is it indeed even possible?
Gee, there are going to be a lot of problems. One is I've always expected the Fed would raise interest rates right after the election. I'm expecting that'll happen in December. That's going to make it a little tougher. The other thing is, hey, we played that game for the last 8 years. We've doubled, you know, the public debt. We didn't get all that much out of it, when truth be told. We've created a tremendous Wall Street boom. But in the process, we've shifted money from savers down to Wall Street executives, which isn't exactly your idea of social justice. So there isn't as much wiggle room as, say, Obama had in 2008. I also don't like the idea of just taking $1 trillion and throwing it in the wall and seeing what sticks. But that said, yeah, there's a lot of stuff you can do with infrastructure. I mean, you know, there are a lot of good projects. I mean, the project should be judged on the basis of, does this just make sense, right, rather than a make-work program that has no economic purpose. There are a lot of things we can do that have an economic purpose. But, you know, I look at that and I say, oh, okay, you know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of the Eisenhower, you know, interstate highway system. Or it reminds me of the Great Lakes Seaway program. I mean, these were Eisenhower initiatives. And the Republicans back then had absolutely no problems about doing those sorts of things. Or I think even about the idea that a good administration should be concerned with the welfare of all Americans, not just the top 10%.
Mm-hmm. So what would boost the wages of people? Would it be another program? Like, I don't even know what it would be. Bridges, and there are a lot of roads that are in disrepair. Would it be that? Would it be another let's go to the moon project, but let's go somewhere else?
Well, you know, I'm a great fan of John F. Kennedy. And you know, if we could somehow get back to the political parties of the 60s, that would be okay in my book, you know. So the moon project with Kennedy, yeah, that was quite admirable. I don't have a list of bridges that need to be fixed. Okay, I mean, I have no clue. But if you want to help people, the best social policy and the most just one is do that which has the effect of creating jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and by the way, I mean, there's this debate on the right about what the nature of the problem is, and kind of the official right wing, and I hate this, the kind of official right wing story is blame the victim. And the blame the victim story is, oh, these are basically guys from West Virginia who are sniffing oxy, you know, and they come from broken homes and they right. get divorced and all that. And it's kind of interesting because we had exactly the same debate 40-odd years back about black unemployment and unwed births and all that. And this fellow, William Julius Wilson at the time, said, no, wait a minute. It's really an economic issue. It's not, don't blame the victims. These guys don't have jobs, period. I completely agree with that. I think that the job issue is paramount. You fix the job issue and, hey, our morals will take care of themselves. Stop blaming the victims. So we really need the kinds of programs that are going to put Americans back to work. And importantly, African Americans. Who I think are the kind of people who are hurt by immigration, right? I mean, when you look at a sensible immigration policy, let's start by asking, what if Americans count? I mean, how do you make Americans better off? It's not just how do you make the world better off. The way every country looks at it is, how do you make native people better off? Canada has far more foreign-born than the U.S. I mean, we're about 15%. Canada's about 20%. Australia's 25%. It's not a political issue in Australia or Canada, even with a greater number of foreign-born. Why? Because the policy is based on helping native Canadians or native Australians. And when you do that, you can then be generous in other respects. And I'm thinking here, for example, of Canada's policy about Syrian refugees. I mean, it's got a great policy. It's taken in nearly 50,000 people so far. And we're struggling to take in 11,000. And part of it has to do with the fact that nobody trusts the government to get it right. I mean, we're a very low-trust country in terms of do we trust each other and do we trust the government. And that has a lot to do with the social pathologies of American government at this point. If we could trust the government more, then we might be able to do something more appropriately generous with respect to Syrian refugees. Because don't forget, the reason why the refugees in the first place is because of the idiocy of the last 15 years of U.S. foreign policy. So, we caused the problem, and then like a child in a toy shop, we broke it and then we walked away from it. Almost the worst thing you can say about an untrustworthy government is that the noblest of American impulses, which is this is the most generous country in the world, gets stifled when you can't trust the government to do it right. Mm.
But many would say that Donald Trump also added to this by saying not only don't trust the government, don't trust the Muslims, don't trust the immigrants, they're rapists, they're criminals. He paraded people on the stage who had relatives killed by people who were here illegally, but it's a much smaller number than what he said. Doesn't he add to the whole problem by blaming the victims here?
Well, the victims are, in the cases you mentioned, were Americans who were killed by people who were here without documents. Of course we're not going to do a religious-based immigration system. In other words, if you're Muslim, you don't get in. I mean, it should be, as it is in countries like Australia and Canada, it should be a system based on bringing in people who are going to add to the country. And, you can't have priests as immigration officials accepting people on the basis of their virtues, but economics is a pretty good proxy. So what happens in Canada is if you've got good educational attainments and you can speak English or French and you have some money, then you're more likely, and you're under 40 years of age, then you're more likely to be brought in. And, that's maybe as good a proxy as you can get for virtue. So it works out pretty well. I mean, whereas here, getting back to immobility, we import immobility because the immigrants earn less than Americans, and the effect of that goes down to three generations. So, we become immobile in part because of our immigration policies. And that wears at the national fabric.
We need to pause for a moment and we'll welcome phone calls for you. Our guest this hour is F.H. Buckley, professor at George Mason University's Scalia School of Law. He is the author of The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America. He's a senior editor at the American Spectator, a columnist for the New York Post, and has written for many other publications. We will also move into some of the cabinet-level positions. We'll talk about the Secretary of Education, and we will welcome your phone calls. Here's how you reach our conversation. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we always like to read your messages. And we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, phone calls coming in, 800-486-8655. And Frank, we start with Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask your guest about when you talk about government policy and helping everyone to create jobs, isn't it best always to be creating private sector jobs as opposed to public sector jobs? And the public sector jobs that you do create, shouldn't they be one-time type of jobs, such as building a bridge or repairing a road that when done, that you then get that person to go out into the private sector rather than being dependent on the public sector? And again, if we think about JFK being a hero of yours, then we also have to say about LBJ that we develop a bloated government that doesn't work well for anyone. Thanks so much. Bye.
Thanks for the call, Frank.
Charlie, thank you for the call. Yeah, I'm very much in sympathy with what you say. I mean, a private sector job will be more permanent in all likelihood, and a private sector job has a greater badge of efficiency. But we shouldn't think that public sector jobs are necessarily wasteful. There are a lot of things that have to be done by government, highways, bridges, and airports and the like. And the test in all cases should be, is this going to make some kind of business sense? And the concern with respect to public spending, well, there are a couple of them. One is that government makes a lousy venture capitalist, as Roger Reich put it. And the other thing is the concern with respect to political payoffs. So, you know, there are those kinds of concerns, but nevertheless, it still remains the case that there's an important role for government in a lot of spending decisions. And hopefully, you know, knock wood, it's the case that the right kinds of projects will be green-lighted by a Trump administration.
Hmm. Did you have any problems with the character of Donald Trump? Many people have, and let's talk about it in terms of some of his business dealings. If indeed he wants to, which is a real worthy goal, to put people to work and get jobs for them that are good-paying, family-supporting jobs, he's got these things hanging over his head, this whole $25 million settlement for Trump University where people wanted to make better lives for themselves, and they weren't able to. It was a fraud. He has Polish workers who worked on the Trump Tower who were paid $4 an hour, who still have a suit against him. 18 years later, he's been known to stiff his people who have worked for him, contractors. Do you have problems with that in believing that he's going to be able to really, in good faith, make more money for people?
Well, I'm, you know, do I worry about private virtue lacking in Trump in some respects? I belong to this organization of reprobates, of publicans, of tax collectors, thieves, prostitutes, called the Catholic Church. So I'm quite familiar with vice. It's a church built upon it. And then again, I live in an academic community, and I see all the envies of greed and envy that one could ever imagine in amongst my colleagues and in the academic world generally. I mean, what for libels, tumults, and pasquinades, there's no going there by day, and 'tis worse by night. Trump's problems as well, speaking as an academic, in part have to do with somebody who didn't have the kind of rough edges that get rubbed off when you hang around with, let's say, the elite in some way. And being a developer isn't necessarily being a member of the elite. There are things you learn not to say. Unless you're frozen in aspect around the year 1965, which is a totally different experience, and then you said things that, you know, if you hung around the academic world, you'd learn not to ever say. But he never got those kinds of lessons. As to his business dealings, yeah, I've heard things. I mean, he's taken advantage of the bankruptcy laws and all. He's used the laws in all the ways that you would expect a New York businessman to use them. Right. But in truth, I have good friends who say, oh, I know these people who really were hard done by Trump, and I would have to know more about the business to know more about that, and I don't. I mean, I haven't followed up. There are problems with for-profit universities, certainly, and I guess Trump University was one of them. As to settling that lawsuit, well, you don't want it hanging over you if you're president, that's all.
Let's go to Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Hi, what a great guest. I hope you bring him back. Very interesting.
You mentioned the
bankruptcy laws. I would like to see a show done on who wrote those bankruptcy laws. Could we dig into that? But my comment is about infrastructure in our country and what Trump has said he wants to do and what Obama said he wanted to do and actually did. And I'll give you two examples. Mr. Obama had his big sign out in front of a condo on Milwaukee's east side on Brady and Prospect that said, you know, this project is being funded by Mr. Obama's, you know, Restoration Act or whatever it was. And they were insulating a condominium for wealthy people. And when I called my alderman about this, you know, why are we putting public money into a private condominium? The aldermen had them take that sign down within 2 days. But you also brought up the project, the Race to the Moon. Let me bring up a place in Milwaukee which is probably as alien to most white Milwaukeeans as the moon. It's 20th and Center Street in Milwaukee, where average children cannot walk to school safely. Families are not safe. If Mr. Trump could somehow find a way to help inner-city Milwaukee, inner city South Chicago, so that it is not a war zone, and involve the people that live there. Somehow pay the people that live there to help protect their own neighborhoods. I wouldn't mean snitches on every block, but something different than sending in the cops, you know, the Gestapo, to just shoot everybody they see, they think is a criminal. If we could somehow involve people that live within these communities. Inner city Milwaukee is one of the worst places in the United States.
All right. Thanks, Ray, for the call. Do you think that the president-elect will focus attention on central cities?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, Ray. I agree entirely with what you said. I'm not sure quite what the answer is. Policing has to be part of it. Schools has to be part of it as well. I know that the Trump team paid particular attention to trying to communicate to African Americans that, you know, we are really looking out for you. You know, by the way, I think part of what's going on here is a certain betrayal by established organizations like the NAACP, which has come out against charter schools and come out against restrictions on immigration, which is totally contrary to the interest of African Americans. So, you know, Trump's message was, look, you know, you've been supporting the Democrats, and we understand that, but give us a chance because it hasn't paid off all that well for you, and we're going to try to do better. And I certainly hope that that works out.
What did you think of the education secretary appointment?
Well, I don't know her, but I like the idea of school choice a lot. I know you've got a lot of that up in Wisconsin. I told you that I spent most of my life in Montreal, and before I left Montreal, I had at that point a five-year-old daughter, and I could have put her into a French Catholic school or a French Protestant school or an English Catholic school or an English Protestant school or a Jewish school, all of which were state-supported. And that's basically a legacy of a very different kind of constitutional structure, which was much more favorable to religion than the United States. But, you know, but the point is that after sectarian differences lessened, then what you ended up with was basically choice. And choice is great for everybody. It's great for the kids who get to go to better schools, but it's also good for failing schools that have to pull themselves up by the britches and do a better job. The differences between educational attainments of 15-year-olds in the States and Canada are just amazing. You know, somebody calculated that if we could somehow magically raise ourselves up to Canadian levels, it'd be like a $1 trillion boost to the economy. And you know something? You'll hear people say, oh, this is, you know, they won't admit it, but, you know, they'll say this is all about race, and that's nonsense. It's not. It's not about race. It's about just bad schools. Right. If you just, I mean, first of all, the suggestion that one third of American kids don't quite count is despicable. But secondly, if you take the two thirds of American white kids, they perform worse, significantly worse, much worse than all Canadians. And remember, we're talking about a country that's 20% foreign born. So it's just, there's just no comparison, and I think choice has a lot to do with it. So to the extent that she institutes choice, I think that's fine. The point is not to weaken public schools. The point is to make all schools better.
And yet when you look, and there have been a lot of studies, because we've had choice here in Milwaukee for a long, long time, those who are attending choice schools simply aren't performing better than public school students.
Well, you know, the nationwide studies I've seen are ones that suggest that choice has advantaged people. So there's a battle of the experts on all this, but choice is really what characterizes Canadian experience, and the Canadian experience is their students are just vastly better than ours.
It's not all Canadian provinces, though, is it?
It's not all Canadian provinces. It's Ontario, Quebec, a lot of the western provinces. I mean, it's really rather complicated. I'll just give you one little example. You know, I grew up in a little French-Canadian town in western Canada, and all my teachers were nuns because it was like 99% French-Canadian. And, you know, at one point I talked to a friend of mine, an African-American judge, and he said, didn't anybody object to that? I mean, it was a public school. And these teachers were nuns. I said, and he was shocked. And I said, yeah, there was a group that objected, and it was called the Ku Klux Klan. And, so we're paying in part for our legacy of bigotry by opposition to choice.
There are concerns that the new Education Secretary, Betty DeVos, is anti-public education and a strong believer in schools being run by private companies. What do you think about private companies, and do you think that's Trump's direction here for schools and her direction or not?
You know, when you talk about choice to Americans, they tend to focus on charter schools, and some of them are you know, for-profit, I guess, or effectively so by virtue of salaries. You know, when you get down to it, what would shake out would be a choice between religious institutions and public institutions. Because religious institutions, which will not discriminate, of course, will have tremendous advantages in running schools, as they always have. So, I have no problems with that. I think it's important for DeVos to signal that she's not opposed to public schools, that she wants the best possible choice for all people. And, you know, by the way, which is how it works here in the district. The district here, the District of Columbia, has a charter school program, and the public school principals go door to door to try to solicit people to come to their schools. I love it, right? That's competition.
Let's go. Thank you, Ray, for your call. Let's go to Jackie in Sun Prairie. Hi, Jackie.
Hi there. A couple of things come to mind here. When we talk about, you know, poverty, people who are in poverty, and blaming them for being in poverty, I really don't believe in that at all. I believe in, rather than blaming, we need to do something about it. But it just seems to me that, especially in the white South, I wonder how many of the areas, pockets of poverty, are they getting a decent education in their public or private or any schools for that matter?
Golly, I don't know what the answer is to that. I think that I'm not indeed quite sure what you're referring to. If you're referring to social ills like divorce or whatnot, I don't think that any government is equipped to improve moral standards. The only kind of moral rearmament program that I know of is give people jobs. And after that, I think it'll take care of itself. I mean, the strongest of human emotions is the desire that one's children do well. And that's normally all it takes, right? So, you know, give people jobs. I mean, the thing is, people don't smoke or sniff Oxy. They don't lose their jobs because they sniff Oxy. if they sniff oxy, it's because they don't have jobs and they're depressed over that, right? So it's jobs are paramount, and in that respect, I agree with Wilson.
Thanks, Jackie, for the call. Paul sends this email to, with no evidence or apparent justification, discount the votes of millions of people that Trump and his administration will represent. In my mind, that single statement thoroughly identifies him as unsuitable for the presidency. I've held my tongue mostly among friends and strangers, but this really is a bridge too far. It shows his thorough lack of respect for the institution vis-a-vis the electorate and the election process that placed him there.
Well, that's a good statement of indignation. One gets a lot of that, actually. But allow me to change the subject slightly and again to recall that I grew up under a parliamentary system. It seems to me that Americans worry too much about their presidents. Pascal said that there is a God-shaped hole in our hearts. In a secular society, I'm afraid it's now become an Obama-shaped hole or a presidential-shaped hole. Whereas if you grew up in a parliamentary system, you begin to think that politicians are roughly the lowest form of scum that God ever permitted to crawl upon the face of the earth. So you don't worry too much about all of that. I'm not going to comment further on that.
You don't think that administrations set policy that is important for our lives?
Yeah, it is important, but the president ain't going to save your soul, and minimal goals are approximately the best you can hope for. So, when I think of Trump, what I'm thinking of is it the case that he will have the kind of policies that will get America working again? Will we see stupid, adventuresome, attempts to remake the world as we saw, particularly under George W. Bush? No, I see a more sensible foreign policy, and I hope a much more sensible domestic policy as well. And that's what I'm interested in.
Frank Buckley, Foundation Professor at George Mason University Scalia School of Law, author of The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America, a senior editor at The American Spectator. We're welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go next to Lee in Williams Bay. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm really concerned about this alt-right movement that seems so closely aligned with Trump and Bannon, his appointee.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered about the guest's impressions or concerns regarding this association with this racist and bigoted group. Thank you. I'll take my answer off air. Thank you.
Lee. Thanks for the call.
Well, thanks for the call. I guess in a way I don't feel obliged to respond in the sense that these guys have absolutely nothing to do with me any more than, alt-right idiots or alt-left idiots might have anything to do with somebody, some Democrat. We're talking about people who basically have spent their lives underneath a pet rock and have only emerged from their obscurity because they seem to be a convenient way of beating up on Trump. Trump has disowned them. I mean, I don't know what else you have to do. So I don't think they in any respect represent anything like the people around Trump. I mean, Trump himself and his kids were basically Democrats a couple of years back. And, anything further from these creeps, I can't imagine. They're basically New Yorkers.
What about Steve Bannon?
I don't know Bannon. I mean, he's a guy from Richmond, Virginia, who spent some time in the military and who seems to have an incredible talent at provoking people. But, I wouldn't see him in any respect as somebody favorable to the alt-right, as at least that portion of the alt-right is so described as, which the listener had in mind. Alt-right seems to be an umbrella term, and it comes down importantly to something like a smear. The smears of 50 years back were people who were fellow travelers of communists. This seems to me the same sort of thing. I mean, a lot of honorable people back in the 1950s lost their jobs, or some of them lost their jobs because they were tarnished by some allegations of left-wing bias. But they were just regular Americans, and so are these guys, the people we're talking about, Bannon and these guys.
Except there are some who were deeply troubled that he ran this site that really gave a forum for people who have pretty despicable views to write what they thought about race, about Jews, about immigrants, about a number of people. There's a lot of concern about that. Understandable,
well,
do you think?
If you're referring to Breitbart.com, I don't know that that's accurate. My wife, who is Jewish, says she has no feelings of fear with respect to any of these people. The only people she'd be worried about would be the extreme left-wing people on college campuses. They'd be more of a problem for her. He ran provocative news stories. I guess, you know, the one story everybody refers to is a fellow called David Horowitz, who's a bit of a bomb thrower, described Bill Kristol as what, I forget the term, renegade Jew or something like that. And I thought about that, and I thought, well, what the heck does that mean? Of course, I can't get involved. That's their business. But then I thought, is there such a thing as a renegade Catholic? Yeah! Oh, of course, Martin Luther, for gosh sakes. I mean, do I have a problem with that? No, I mean, if you talk about somebody being a renegade Catholic, then you're trying to defend Catholic orthodoxy, I think. And I guess that was the point of what Horowitz said. But he's a bomb thrower. I just printed the story.
Who, Bannon is the bomb thrower or Horowitz is the bomb thrower?
Horowitz.
Let's go next to Elaine in Colfax. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. Kathleen, you mentioned the speech of Donald Trump, the hatred that he showed through his speech towards Mexicans, Islam, all kinds of varied people. And I was going to say that your guest made an apology as if he had rubbed shoulders with academics. He would not speak this way. He would learn how to tone down his racism. And that's just not in my experience. I think the way you're raised, the way your parents speak, the way the values you're taught is reflected in how you speak. And it is not some kind of Donald Trump isn't a man with a good heart deep down. His speech reflects who he is.
Well, you seem to see deeper into people's souls than I do, I'm afraid. So I really can't comment on that. I think I can speak about academics more accurately, and I'm not in love with them.
What do you expect from the Donald Trump presidency? Are you looking forward to it? Do you think there will be significant changes early on?
Yeah, I hope so. I think it'll be a vast improvement over that which went before in the Republican Party, and I think it represents a return to the center in American politics, and that I welcome. It'll also represent a return to a party that's more concerned about people than it is about mere right-wing ideology. I mean, if there's one thing he's not, and Trump is not an ideologue in the way that Romney was or the way that Paul Ryan is. I mean, I think he'll approach policy problems on the basis of not... Does this correspond with my geometric view of human relations, but is this really going to make people better off? That's more or less what I've understood from the campaign, and that's what I'm hoping for.
Mm-hmm. What about global warming? Judy sends an email, just briefly an answer. Carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere over 400 parts per million. She says that we should be creating a level playing field so fossil-free industries like solar, wind, advanced batteries have a fair shot at creating good private sector jobs. Will Trump move in that direction?
I wouldn't be surprised if he did, to some extent. I mean, one question one gets from time to time is, oh, is he betraying his constituency because, after all, he gave an interview to the New York Times in which he expressed some questions about either for or against global warming. And I think an accurate summary of what he said is, look, I don't know all that much about it. I'm curious about it. He expressed, I think, a certain amount of skepticism as to whether or not this is a problem that can be easily solved by vast expenditures of government money.
And on that note, we'll have to say goodbye and see what he does on that. Frank, thank you very much. We're out of time. Thanks for being with us.
Kathy, thanks so much.
Frank Buckley, professor at George Mason University Scalia School of Law, senior editor at the American Spectator, author of The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this show, and thanks to Zeb Gozman for on-air production.